we are all students of Frank Parker's, and we've all learned an enormous amount from him. I'd like to know, to get us started, by asking those students who've worked with Frank, those who, let us say, have less of a sense of deja vu than some of us have about some of these arguments and discussions, to ask the first question. So, any of the folks, any of our students in the room, any of the recent graduates or not-so-recent graduates work with Frank?
I'm Brooke Tame.
Let's go ahead and use the mic, if that's all right. Can we pass the mic around?
Okay.
And if we could, is that okay? Answer, give a synopsis of the question, just because it's on video, that would be very helpful.
My question is for Dr. Cochran. There is an interesting dichotomy between your talk and the last one by Adam Levin. And it seems rather interesting, coming from the generation of women inheriting a lot of this problem, that you presented some really good arguments as to why the licensing may not occur. So, in the spirit of stewardship, what do you propose for an immediate choice? Something that, because clearly by not making the choice and by saying that, you know, all of these problems that exist are going to prevent us from storing this spent fuel in a permanent site, we're clearly inheriting another series of risks by trying to transform, you know, potentially an internal site. What do you propose for the immediate future, let's say in the next 10, 15 years, for a solution to the storage issue?
If we can use the mic. The short answer is, and operating reactors, I would propose that they continue to do what they're doing today. That is, they use pool storage and then they use dry gas storage at the operating reactor site. There are about, I don't remember the precise number, 9, 11 sites where there is spent fuel stored but the reactor has been retired. I believe it's appropriate to establish an interim spent fuel storage site, dry gas storage site, for shutdown reactors. I don't think that makes any sense for operating reactors. So that would be my proposal. I think spent fuel can be stored safely in dry gas.
For how long?
As long as you manage it. The argument for a geologic repository is that you cannot rely on the continued government entities and so forth for the period of time that would be required for the storage of the materials. But as long as you guard and paint the casks, you can store the spent fuel safely in the casks. You should remember that the real hazard is when the reactor is operating and we license them and they operate. After the spent fuel is removed, you don't have the same heat loading. You can safely store that fuel underwater. After it's removed from the pools in 3 to 5 years, there's not a lot you can do to it to cause serious harm. Shake it with an earthquake and these things may fall over, may get some breach, but I don't think there'd be serious public harm from storage or dry gas storage with spent fuel, short of a very remote chance that somebody would shoot them with a bazooka or something like that, and even there the consequences would not be extremely high.
A great starting question. Any other comments?
I'd like to reiterate on some comments that I made during my presentation. That is that storing spent fuel on our sites truly is an operational distraction. We don't want to be in the position of having to move fuel twice or three times or four times. We'd like to be able to get it back into the fuel pool. Once it's sat in the fuel pool for a period of time, put it into a conveyance that takes it away from our sites. To have to take it out and put it in dry storage at our sites is an operational distraction for us and is very expensive.
Any other?
Behind you.
Thank you. My name is Bob Waters, and I was a student of Frank's back in the early 90s. My question is for the whole panel, and it has to do with transportation of the waste to WIP. Adam had a few comments on that, very good, and made it clear that the issues are not technical in nature, the hardest issues. And, you know, we heard from some of all the speakers, Yucca Mountain, we deal with Nevada primarily, and in opposition to Nevada, to Yucca Mountain. We have transportation, there are multiple governments to deal with, many states and within states, counties, municipalities. And so in terms of the institutional issues that the Academy pointed out, what is the right strategy from the different panel members' perspectives of engaging those governments to get the necessary support so that when a repository is available or interim storage is available or whatever the next solution is that will require movement, what's the right strategy that we can actually cause that movement when we need to?
I'll take a cut at answering that first. When I took this job, it was very obvious to me that DOE was not where it needed to be in terms of doing the strategic planning associated with the transportation process that it needed to do. And so I gave the group direction to develop a national transportation strategic plan, which they've now issued in a draft form. The purpose of the plan is to lay out for the public what the timelines are, what the processes are, the entire transportation issue from route selection decisions, emergency planning, local emergency response funding, a wide range of issues. This is a very complex program to make it work the right way. And so from my perspective, the way to answer your question is to get, DOE needs to get clear first what are all the pieces of the puzzle in turn, and what the timelines are, and then communicate it to the country regarding what it needs to do when, what the processes are for decision making, when people get to play in those decision making processes, and what the end dates are that we're trying to achieve. There are already a number of transportation consultant groups, I'm using that word incorrectly, consultant, transportation coordinating committees between DOE and local and state parties and governments across the country. And there have been interactions going on for several years now between DOE and these various coordinating committees. So it's already in progress. And as we've gotten more visibility with the program over the last couple of years, people are starting to pay more attention to it. But I think the answer to your question is, DOE needs to get its act together in terms of what it's going to do, by when, and communicating clearly to the public what the process is, what the timelines are, and then encouraging that participation as we go through and make decisions.
Yeah, I certainly think the board is right that when DOE lays out its plan, that's going to stimulate a lot of dialogue. But I wonder, because right next to you, my colleague Kevin Crowley, charge of going to distance report, and I know they held a number of meetings around the country talking with their constituency about the transportation issues. I'd be curious what Kevin learned from that.
Well, the report actually made several recommendations, but I think you can encapsulate them in with sort of two overarching ideas. The first is to engage the people who will be affected by the transportation program very early. And there were two particular recommendations that the committee made. One was to work with the local governments and stakeholders on routing decisions early on in the program. And the second is to work with them on emergency responder training. And I know that Ward and his group have been doing both of those things. The other recommendation involves managing what the committee called social risks. You can think of transportation risks as being technical and social. The social risks, I think, are less well understood and less well addressed. And one of the specific recommendations the committee made was for DOE to work with its, Ward, I think it's the technical external or transportation external coordination group.
Yeah.
Is your committee that works with local stakeholders to develop, to put some experts on that group who have social risk backgrounds, and to help DOE think about how it can help, how it can manage the social risks from transportation programs. And I know that Gary Lanthrum, the director of your transportation program, has been talking to a couple of our committee members about getting some help in that area.
Okay, well, let me just see if there's any more. Frank Spinitz, and we thank Barbara Toffer for the excellent idea of asking them first, because they were excellent questions.
I have a question. I can probably just speak loudly enough for everybody here. My name is Leah Spradley, and this question is directed mainly at Adam and Ward's throat. Ward, you had mentioned that you're having discussions, DOE is having discussions now with industry and through NEI trying to think of a new structure that we could use for managing the back end of the fuel cycle. And I'd like to hear what is this structure ideally from both the industry perspective and the government perspective? How is the budgeting controlled? How is the governance set up? And what legally needs to happen to have that sort of private-public partnership?
Regarding the thinking that's going on right now regarding how to better manage the back end of the fuel cycle, the number one, whatever we do will need require legislative changes. That's clear. But the first part is, let's get everybody on the same page about what the objectives are and what success would look like if we do it right. And there are a few top-level givens that have to occur. One is that there is assurance of a funding stream. In other words, whether it's the nuclear waste fund or a new fund or a revenue stream, whatever public and or whatever public slash private entity is created to manage the back end of the fuel cycle needs to have an assurance of a revenue stream and a financing stream so it can execute its mission. That's one of the fundamental problems that we have right now that needs to get fixed. The second is what I call the continuity of leadership and management approach. This idea of having a political appointee who's comes in for a year or 2 years or 2.5 years every 4 years to run this just is not a viable long-term approach. The third is if you take a look at the issue of are we going to recycle as a country, reprocess as a country or not? Are we going to, how do we minimize taxpayer liability associated with standard contracts that are currently in place? It seems to make sense to take a look at those set of issues in a holistic way. The way we're set up right now is we're assuming our whole framework is based on an assumption of once through a fuel cycle, comes out of the reactor, you stick it in the ground, you never go back and get it again. I think most people in this room would recognize that while maybe the economics have driven us and politics have driven us there over the past 30 years, it's unlikely that the economics and the politics will keep us in that same kind of a model long term. And therefore, having a process and a organization which can manage the back end of the fuel cycle for the country in a integrated manner, recognizing the options that we will have in front of us going forward, seems to make sense. So how you set up that kind of a legal entity, is it public, private, is it private, is it what its governance structure is, all of those, there are different models that are out there, some of which have worked, some of which haven't worked. What's very clear is that, to me at least, is that if we go forward with doing something like this, which I personally believe is the right way of going, it's got to be done right. Because if it's not done right in terms of fixing the funding issue, in terms of things associated with the assignment of liability and standard contracts, in terms of governance, we will have made no progress and spent a lot of time and a lot of money and just spinning our wheels. So it's got to be done right. But if it's done right, I think it can be a major step forward for us as a country.
No, I don't have much to add to that other than those points that the board has mentioned. All of them have to be done. You know, if any one of them misses, then this program would fail. So it's an opportunity, I think, that we're looking forward to work with the administration on setting something like this up. And in the meantime, our responsibility is making sure that we can keep the fuel in a configuration that is acceptable to whatever future processing or disposal it is headed for.
Well, probably the person in the room with the most history of a public-private partnership, Chuck Harris.
I'm fascinated by two things that have been fundamental for the last 30 years that got put in motion in this discussion here.
The first place, it sounds to me as if Dr. Kohlgeyser and Tom Cochran, although I'm not sure I'm right about this, have raised a fundamental question about a fundamental assumption that was made back since 1978, which is that the appropriate way to manage these wastes is to put them someplace where nobody ever has to manage them again. You said that you were not quite sure about that question. You thought that was a suspect notion, Mr. Kohlgeyser. And if I understood Tom Cochran's response, he wants to keep the spent fuel under management. He's worried about putting it anywhere else, certainly under the current conditions of the definition by which the standards would be set forth and the procedures would occur, possibly even under the form of the management's being done. It sounds to me as if that fundamental question about whether or not there should be ongoing management rather than sort of short-term management of this, put into dialogue also the issues associated with reprocessing, because the reason one does reprocessing, one tries to go through those separation and transmutation questions is precisely to try to see whether or not you can, in fact, reduce the longevity of some of the things that have made us have to worry about issues for a million years. Is this panel putting the fundamental question, the fundamental assumptions of the 1978 interagency regulatory group?
Let me start. To some extent, I was. I'm in favor of sort of expanding options as opposed to foreclosing options, making decisions that may turn out to be causes real problems trying to fix after the fact. What I thought was suspect, which I think really was the spoken intent of the 1982 Act, was that our responsibility to future generations is for this generation, and by that I mean over the next 50 years or so, to solve this problem permanently. I don't think that's a decision we have to make right now. I think in the long term, eventually, we're certainly going to have to go to some sort of permanent disposal that does not require, you know, permanent and continued monitoring. But I would personally have no problem if our decision right now is we don't know enough that we're going to go for the next 100 years, the next 200 years, maybe even longer, with a monitored, retrievable approach for spent fuel until we're sure that we really have the right long-term solution. So I was certainly raising some of the issues that you mentioned.
I have not backed away in any respect from my belief that the long-term appropriate solution is geologic disposal of spent fuel. Yucca Mountain obviously has these problems. In my view, the government is going to roll us and it's going to be stored in Yucca Mountain. I mean, there's at least a high probability of that. If it's not, it would be for some political opposition and not based on any technical criteria. That would be my best guess. I was asked a question about the very short term, what do you do in the interim? And I think dry cask storage is a safe management alternative as long as you're there to manage it. I think it's one of the least risky aspects of the nuclear fuel cycle. But if you step back a little and you look at nuclear power, it has these attractive benefits of being able to generate a lot of electricity, which is very useful, and it can do so without emitting significant greenhouse gases. It has these major problems of proliferation, reactor safety, and long-term waste management. And in the United States, the economics of new plants. The history of the technology and the industry has been, with respect to each of these problems, they're pushed off on the federal government. If it's proliferation, that's a government problem, an IAEA problem, international problem. It's not a problem with the Exelon or the utilities. When it came to reactor safety, utilities wouldn't build the plants unless the government instituted price amnesty. When it came to nuclear waste, the proliferation concerns there, the long-term management concerns there. So the utilities able to push that off, or the government assumed that responsibility. Now we're left with one last issue. That's new plants are not economical in the United States, so what did the industry do? They go and ask the government to pay for it. And here we heard we have a short term until you have a geologic repository problem. Of course, the utility would love to dump that on the government. So you hear the Exelon saying this is a burden. I mean, they're running these huge, complicated reactors. They can run them at 90% capacity factor. They can juggle the spent fuel. They can get it from the reactor to the pad. And they, oh, there's a problem trucking this from the reactor to the pad. It's a distraction. Well, that's nonsense. I mean, there's a cost of doing business if you're going to generate electricity. So in the short term, we have something like 65 reactor sites. There's something like 60 some odd wet spent fuel pools that are going to be there for decades, because these sites are going to be operating, these reactors are going to be operating for decades. The 65 sites are going to have dry cask storage facilities. They can handle the spent fuel as long as they operate those sites, and it's a small concern compared to what's going on at those sites. Where there's a problem that would be helpful to solve with respect to short-term management is at sites that where the reactor closes down, and you want to greenfield the site, and you want to get the spent fuel out of there to some other place, and I think there it makes sense to have some federal management of or private management of interim spent fuel storage. But in the long term, as a society, we have to and should put this underground. And we're not going to solve this by reprocessing and transmuting these wastes. The GNEP program is the marriage of two failed technologies, reprocessing and fast reactors. Reprocessing is uneconomical here and around the world. The French pay 6% more for their electricity because they reprocess their spent fuel. You cannot transmute this waste without something like, for every 100 gigawatts of reactor capacity, you have to have 40 to 75 gigawatts of fast reactor capacity. We spent decades and upwards of $50 billion globally to develop fast reactors as breeders. And and there were makers from the United States, France, Germany, Italy, the United Kingdom, Russia, and Japan. And the flagship reactors in each of those countries were failures. Super Phoenix had a capacity factor of 6% over 11-year lifetime. Manju in Japan operated 4 months, was shut down. Its capacity factor is 0.4%. The German fast reactor was sold to, built and have operated, sold to a hotel owner, and is operated as a hotel and an amusement park. The British fast reactor, Dunray, was shut down. The Italian reactor was never finished. The Russians built them, but they never put plutonium in them, and they never closed the fuel cycle and stuck the U.S. government with a $500 million a year cost of securing their plutonium. I mean, they may have 250 tons of plutonium around the world because of the failure to adequately close fuel cycles around the world. So this is not a solution that's ever going to happen. You should listen to what Rickover said in 1957 or 6 when he jerked the fast reactor, said he was going to jerk it out of the seawall before it went on sea trials because it was costly to build, expensive to maintain, prone to failures even from small design problems and serious problems in trying to repair them. And that's been the history of this technology. I'm not quoting precisely.
Well, I'm going to give this over to Bob for the waiting patiently.
I'm Bob Budnitz, and I was the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, which is a Dewey Laboratory, but I'm sure speaking for myself, I need to start with. I'm going to tell everybody here what deeply disturbs me now in the winter of 2008. I have to preface it by saying I was working next to Margaret Chu for 2 years, 2002-2004, in the office at RW1 where Warren is now sitting. And in November 2004, I voted for a candidate whose public position was to close the project I was working on. That's Kerry. And nothing would get about me. I would never vote for somebody that opposes abortions, things like that. So that has nothing to do with it. And I am absolutely sure that I'm going to vote in November this next year for one of the Democrats. I'm not sure which one it'll be, but I'm sure they're going to do that for other reasons that nothing would get about. But every single candidate decided that I'm going to vote on has already in public position saying they would shut down the program, they're posting up about it, they think that it's crazy, they're giving up all the things you know, the same stuff Harris said. And I don't understand this, but I do understand where it's coming from. Okay. It's coming from there and my deep, and I speak personally, deep commitment to the values of environmental protection, which has somehow, I've been a member of the Sierra Club for 40 years, which somehow spill over into an opposition to nuclear power that doesn't make sense to me. Okay? And when it comes to Yucca Mountain, these people are listening carefully. People like Tom Cochran. Because Tom, to his credit, and I love the guy, and I'll say that straight, I have the highest admiration, has technical credit, sensible things to say, never says something that's dishonest or untrue, is always giving credit to the other side where there's credit to it, and yet comes out where he comes out. So I'm deeply, and it's people like that, I'm sure, who are swaying the few that aren't fanatical nuts, so that my candidates are all saying this. Okay? And I'm trying to figure out what to do about that, and I've got it, and so that's going to lead to my question. So I'm going to make a proposition, then I'm going to ask the question, but the proposition has to be received by a proposition. I surely agree with Tom's analysis in the past. The process by which you ended up with the site selection, the criteria, and all that stuff is completely nuts and flawed and it's wrong and done incorrectly as a matter of policy and incorrectly as a matter of procedure. And the way that we ended up with Part 60 before Part 191, you remember? Of course, Part 60 isn't operative anymore. Now we have Part 63, the next one isn't out yet, although it's coming out soon. And I think that the way the court and now the EPA misread the Academy report I was part of, and there are a bunch of us here, Chris Whipple and John Hearn, are up and running on that panel, The misunderstanding that drives me up. Forget that for the moment. I'm going to make a stipulation and see what I can talk to Tom Cochran about it and then the others. Suppose that I could convince you, Tom, that despite all that, the design we've got at Yucca Mountain, the design of the repository that is going to be submitted to the NRCC, is so sick, and demonstrably so, with so much marketing, with so much convincing evidence, that for sure the doses are going to be trivial for time and no more, way beyond the time that I agree with you is nuts. That is, if you postulate all this on the junk, never mind, I'm going to talk tomorrow about Glacier and stuff, but nevertheless, the doses are just absolutely trivial, not at 18 kilometers, which is also nuts, but also where, you know, of course, because of course, we postulate Boston Institute, which also people live on top of, couldn't they? If we can show that, and if the public, meaning you, could be convinced of that, the way apparently the public is not convinced about reactor safety, it wasn't true in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 30s, but now it's true. If you were convinced of that, would your opposition to that repository disappear? Or would the fact that the process was flawed all these years, which you eloquently spoke about, which I agreed with, be enough to sustain the opposition? Because if one's true, then it's hopeless. But if the other's true, then the facts will speak for themselves. Flawed or not, it may not be the best site, but it's the site. It may not be the best design, but it's the design. And it may not be the lowest doses, but they're low enough. And I don't know what low enough is, but suppose they were way down in the milligram range, which is surely trivial, no matter at any time. So I want to ask that question. And then I want to ask the question of our WD, which is Wartsboro, sitting right next to you, about what mechanism we are, I'm inside this building, we are going to provide so as to enable people like Tom Cochran and others, sound technical professors in universities and so on, to come to the independent view that it's safe, which is, I believe, a necessary condition for its going forward. Because the fact that the things are so difficult to analyze and so on will always arouse suspicion in the minds of people who don't have an independent way of analyzing themselves. Okay? Or who don't have others who may trust to have analyzed it independently who can say that for them. And now the precedent for that, and then I'll shut up and let you answer the question, is that for a long, long time that was true of reactor safety. But now, more or less, the accessibility of the information and the transparent analysis and the operating record has made it such that that opposition has melted away because of the transparent facts, the facts on the ground. The facts of not just the experts, but the facts themselves. Well, that's for a hell of a long time. And so my question to Ward Sprope, which is to follow the question to Tom, is to ask Ward about what the project is doing to make a safety case that will be accessible to, convincing to, and hence important in the public debate for the process which is separate from the NRC's licensing process.
Well, the quick answer is yes.
What's your answer?
I would say, I'm going to make it easy for you. Clearly, Yucca Mountain can safely dispose of some amount of spent fuel. Now, the question is how much? One of the problems we have is that the license is for 70,000 tons. DOE is not prepared to go in and ask for a license for 7,000 tons to say, let's see if we can do this amount and so forth. And people who have a visceral opposition to Yucca Mountain for all the process reasons are gravely concerned that once you, even if you put 7,000 tons in or some fraction, that's the foot in the door. And they're going to come back because, you know, you have on your side, or I should say, Berkeley. You have people like Mayor Peterson who does very good science who will say, hey, I can put not 70,000 tons, but hundreds of thousands of tons that you can get now. So there is a concern that this will not only become a de facto repository until they make progress on this one, we'll start a program to look at the second repository. And maybe it's not logical. And so it's not a technical issue anymore. It's mixed with all of these other considerations that some people don't want to open it because they're scared of where that process will end up. But I would say, you know, if you could set aside all of the politics and just look at the science, run it as an R&D program. Put in, license it as a demonstration program for a small fraction of the amount of material, get past these political hurdles and go out and start looking at it with better science.
Let me try and, Bob, let me try and answer your question about the issue of, so how do you get people to understand this? This license application is going to be over 10,000 pages long. And it is, I'll be very clear, I don't understand it all. I don't have a PhD in geophysical sciences. I don't have a PhD in radionuclide transport. I don't need it. What I do need is I do need people who understand it and who are credible. And I do have that on this program. But one of the things that was very clear to me when I got on board a year and a half ago was that there was kind of like this mindset that, you know, we're going to run this TSPA, which Tom referred to, and it's going to come out with a number. And either the number is good or the number is bad. And either the repository is going to get licensed or it's not. That is not what the regulations, that's not an appropriate interpretation of the regulations, and it's not an appropriate approach to take on the licensing of this repository, given the uncertainties and the long time frames we're talking about. So what was very clear to me was that we needed to produce what I call the qualitative safety case. Right. It's what are all of the various things we have learned over the past 25 years of studying this stuff that you have TSPA and the calculations and coming up with a numerical value is nice and necessary, but it's not sufficient. And therefore, how do we take what we've learned from the natural analogs, from a lot of other information that's out there, and put together, as I said, the qualitative safety case as to why Yucca Mountain is good enough and is in fact safe, appropriately safe for now and for future generations. That document's being written. Now, we are not going to submit it as part of the license application, but we're going to submit it with the license application. That qualitative safety case is probably going to be in the neighborhood of maybe 70, 80 pages long at on its original version, which is going to be targeted to an audience of people in this room who can understand the more technical issues. We're also going to skinny it down to probably a 8 to 10 page version, so the average fifth grade educated person could read it and understand it. And because it's important that I'm able to address both types of audiences, the audience like in this room and the audience that is not smarter than a fifth grader. And they're the audiences we're going to put this qualitative safety case together for, and it's going into the NRC with a license application, but not being a part of the license application, gives us more flexibility in what we're able to say in it and how we're able to present the case.
David Costa, next. Let me point out that tomorrow morning, Roger Casper is going to be speaking on this subject.
David Costa. I'd like to go back to two concepts that Bill Goldwager made at the beginning of this morning. The first is that of this distributional values and equity, that being the cost, benefits, and risk balanced amongst the different populations that may be affected both at the local level and at the national level. And then the issue of evidential values, that being how certain is certain enough. And I'd like to start with Ward commenting and others perhaps commenting on what are the benefits that are derived from the populations that are near the vicinity of Yucca Mountain, and how that may play out if we had interim storage sites, and how does that balance from the county out to the surrounding counties to the state levels that may be affected, because clearly that impacts political decisions that may be there. And what are suggestions about how to approach that? Because regardless of the nature of the facility that we site, that has to be addressed. And secondly, if all of you can comment from your own perspective, how certain is certain enough?
And we have five of
them. My lowest grade as an undergraduate was in probability and statistics. So in terms of coming up with it, trying to address this group on how certain is certain enough, I'm not the person to talk about it. However, what I would say is that, let me go back to the first question, and we have been in discussions, obviously, with the commissioners of the county, of Nye County, and at the county level, they're very interested in talking about the impacts of the repository of the county, the economic development capabilities and opportunities there are for them, and we are content, and the law allows us to have those discussions with them. The law also allows us to have those discussions and reach agreements with the state. The state at this stage of the game has indicated they're not interested in having those discussions. And for the reasons I talked about in the past, is that they're opposed to the program, and I think they will stay. There's no advantage for the politicians to even engage in discussions with the federal government until if and when we get to the point that the repository is a certainty, and that's a ways off. So I think the reality of the situation on the ground is, other than Nye County, which is the immediate potential recipient of financial benefits, the rest of the state and the other counties aren't going to want to play. In terms of how certain is certain enough, what you'll see in the license application is a very disciplined approach to the treatment of uncertainty across the various models. And we made sure that we've got a common approach that hangs together that makes sense in terms of the treatment of those uncertainties. And whether or not we use a mean, whether we use a median, you're going to see both results. I mean, in the license application, you're going to see both results, and people will make their own determination as to whether is how good is good enough. It's the best way you can do it at this stage of the game.
So just my comment, I think one of the most interesting applications in trying to sort through an evidential value issue, obviously, is the licensing of a high-level waste repository. I mean, that is where the details really are very clear. You heard Tom in his comments this morning talk about several aspects of it. What do you mean by defense in depth? Talk about using the mean versus the median versus the table of the distribution. So all of these issues are going to be thoroughly debated and discussed going through the licensing process. At least when I go back to being an academic, it's going to be a great exercise. And the only other thing that I have just for a second, as mentioned in Bob Cousins' comments, although Bob is gone, we did have the issue that with the next president, particularly it might be a Democratic president, the ones who have said they're opposed to Yucca Mountain. We certainly have to think about what is the fallback. What are you going to tell the next president? Maybe it's going to be the sort of thing that Tom suggested, that also to think about Yucca Mountain, really characterizing it more, at least initially, for it as an R&D facility, not saying it's going to be the really making the decision now for all time for the permanent repository. So I certainly have a case sort of thinking broadly about it, how we think about these issues, what the next president is told, but also what it's going to be for the president to follow.
When you said people in the vicinity, were you referring to the county or the filling station and brothel that used to be the...
I hope the county.
But just bear in mind that the affected community goes well beyond that class of people, and it's really the future generations you're trying to protect inside the repository, and therefore you should have some defensible criteria and a defensible process for getting there. And in the 70s, we were asked by John Deutsch what we thought the criteria should be. This was before this EPA developed the approach they did. I thought the closest thing to being neutral to future generations would be to say the repository should be cause no more harm than the original ore bodies from which the uranium is derived to operate the reactors. And I'm sure if they'd taken that approach, it would be all sorts of problems involved in means and medians and so forth. But at least in the long-term assessment, you have the same kinds of uncertainties associated with this, with estimating the risks associated with the ore bodies that you do with the repository itself. So maybe they would have canceled out, I don't know. But that's water under the bridge. I mean, we're not going in that direction.
Adam, there's something you're saying, and we have one last question.
No, no
comment. That's right. I have a broader question to pass the panel to that. We are certainly not about to abandon ionizing radiation as a tool in our society. Use it for medical applications, typical mammographic exams for 700 milligram CAT scans. We use it for thyroid planning, scanning. Certainly in industry, we use it constantly for well determination. In the university, we use carbon-14 today the way we used to use litmus paper when I was in college. Now, some forms of environmental radiation appear to be socially acceptable. Indoor radon, where the householder must pay several hundred dollars to correct it, that problem is being solved by the banks, because when you go to sell a home in New Mexico, they're demanding an inspection to determine that the indoor radon is at low levels. Also, Ward might even comment on it at the test site. As I recall, the inventory of fission products, induced activity, and unfissioned fuel is about 200 million curies. Somehow this seems to be socially acceptable, and yet the concept of putting fission products in a box and then putting it underground is not. So the question I have is, what do you all see that needs to be changed to permit greater acceptability of risk, whether it's by the Congress, by the technical community, or by the public?
I think you're going in the wrong direction. I think you need to start a process to find a second repository site. It's better. I don't think you need to relax your risk standards. I mean, I think you're absolutely correct that people view different types of risk very differently in this. People are completely inconsistent about that. But I don't think we should solve this problem by trying to, as the EPA has done, set the standard on the basis of what some people get in terms of radon exposure and exposure at high altitudes in the West. I think we need to find a better site, and I think we could.
Let me preface my remark by saying I'm probably the least qualified person in this room to talk about this issue in any kind of detail, so I'm not. So I'm giving you my response as a lay person, because I'm not a health physicist. But from a lay person perspective, if the background radiation that people get on an annual basis living in Denver is adequate, and by my definition, it's safe enough, otherwise we're going to be moving people out of Denver. Therefore, if we're going to set a radiation exposure limit for radiation sources like Yucca Mountain, if we're able to maintain the total exposure levels that people will get from Yucca Mountain to levels at or below what the average background radiation is in the U.S., by my definition, it's good enough and it's safe enough.
I'm probably not far behind Ward in terms of my level of understanding and appreciation. I think the bottom line with me is that risk is something that you don't do an adequate job today of conveying to Joseph, and I think we need to do a little better. I agree with Ward from the standpoint that, in my personal view, an acceptable risk of 100 milligram, 200 milligram, 300 milligram, that to me is a perfectly acceptable standard. I don't have any problems with that whatsoever. But it is something that I understand. It's something that I'm scientifically familiar with. So I think that if our focus really needs to be upon doing a better job of communicating what the risks are and how they compare to other risks in the
The only thing I might say is I don't think the public has ever individually wants to go understand all the details of risk assessment. I mean, obviously what they're looking at is do they have confidence and trust in the people that make the decisions. In fact, they don't at the moment. I mean, if you're an individual citizen, it pays to be skeptical about promises that are made by government. So I think, unfortunately, that's what we're having.
Well, let me finish by saying that as half the physicians in the audience, I would point out that cancer risk is now considered to not just be generalized into the future being unchanged, but Frank alluded to that earlier. We haven't really considered that at all. Let me thank you folks. I mean, you started us off in an excellent way, really groundbreaking.